The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Ted Kravitz, you will know from Sky Sports and, of course, before that from ITV and BBC, covering F1 now, I think, into his third and a bit, maybe even fourth decade of covering the sport. He's just written the book F1 Insider Notes from the Pit Lane, and he's with us this morning. Ted, good morning.
Good morning, Anton. Ted, yeah, third decade will do me. maybe, God willing, there'll be a fourth, but I'm not counting the chickens just yet.
And worth pointing out that you started as a mere child when you began.
I did, yes. Not too long out of university, but enough to not be completely wet behind the ears. So yeah, I was the lowest of the low in the TV terms. A logger, someone who would sit down and log tapes and just write down what was on them and let the producers know where the shots were and everything. I think it's a job now that's done by some sort of AI machine, but at the time they needed a human to do it, and that was me.
Now, there is a rule, as I understand it, that legally when you discuss Formula One in any depth, there are two questions that you have to begin with. The first is, greatest ever. Go.
Well, for me, it was Ayrton Senna, because it was just sort of caught up in the myth that was the great man. I never got to work with him, never got to meet him, despite working in the same sport a bit later on. And so I don't know whether that would have changed had I worked with him or had I met him and interviewed him, but for me it was always Senna. He was exotic in that way that, you know, Brazilian racing drivers were and would always hoist the Brazilian flag. He was obviously proud of where he's from, used it to further the interests of Brazil, and that seemed a million miles away from me growing up in Europe and the UK. So he was always the best, and the fact that he was the best, you know, that I think something draws people to the best, whether it's Ayrton Senna or Michael Schumacher or Max Verstappen these days. You like him because you can appreciate greatness and you see that he's obviously the best at what he does. And in my days, that was Senna.
Is that not national treachery on your part? What about Mansell or Hill or Hamilton?
Well, I mean, I've worked with Lewis Hamilton, so maybe I'm too close to the subject. And, you know, sure, I love the battling nature of Nigel Mansell. There was always something happening when Nigel Mansell was around. And Damon Hill's story is just, you know, fantastic, and carrying on and being a champion after his father Graham was, of course, as well. But yeah, maybe I'm too close to those guys.
I remember years ago talking to a friend of mine whose daughter was racing karts, and she was at a kart track in Ireland. She was only very small at the time. I think she was only 9 or 10, and she was driving around, and she came in, and there was another group who were racing on the same circuit. You know, this was just fun karting as opposed to full on competitive at the time. And she came in fuming. She said, "Daddy, I can't catch that man in front of me." And the reason was the man was Damon Hill, which I think is setting a pretty high bar. Now, the other question then that you always get asked, number one is the thing of who's the best. The other is, which era is the best from? As in, would Fangio beat Hamilton? Would Ayrton Senna beat Max Verstappen?
Wow, that is a good one. I mean, in those cars that were the best will always be the best in whatever machinery. So you've got these big cars now that weigh, you know, upwards of 800 kilos, almost a ton. It's almost what your road car weighs, even though they're meant to be, you know, the lightest racing machines on the planet. But if you go back to the, you know, the late 90s and 80s, when I was growing up, they were light, they were nimble. The car that Ayrton Senna won the European Grand Prix at Donington Park in, that McLaren MP4-8, always, it looked quick just standing still. And I like to think those are the ones. The drivers were quite exposed. There wasn't the halo head protection as there is now. And it was really kind of a true open cockpit formula. And I like to think the likes of Fangio, who maybe was a slightly bigger man, muscular man, because those cars that he drove demanded that, might have been able to get into those cars and thought, oh, do you know what? With a day's testing, I might be able to challenge Ayrton Senna. So, I think the best will always come out, whatever the machinery. But for me, it was the late 80s and 90s. That was my favourite period.
Well, it's interesting given that your role now, and you reference this in the book, your role and what you are known for a lot is your technical analysis and the sort of the look at the technology of Formula One. Do you regret how technical it has become?
No, regret's the wrong word, because I appreciate the amazing bits of technology that can hopefully have an impact on our lives. You know, when you see there's some engine technology, which means they're using a third less fuel. Well, I'd quite like to use a third less fuel when I fill up at the pumps. It would save me a few bobs. So, you know, that's good technology that can be transferred to our lives. And also, if it can cut emissions, then that's great as well. It's the unnecessary technology, I think, that sometimes the unseen stuff that I think, well, that's, you know, maybe not applicable to normal life. And it's just food for engineers getting excited about their stuff. Nothing wrong with that. Great for engineers to get excited about their work. But I think if it doesn't really translate, and if it means that I can't explain it to my viewers and listeners, and that this is amazing, look at this, this will mean that if you brake suddenly, you're not going to crash into the car in front, you know, because there's anti-lock braking that was started in Formula One. Some of that technology started, anti-lock braking started in Formula One. That means that's going to save you, save your car, save a life possibly. And that's the transferable technology that I like. The widgets and smidgets and things that the engineers get excited about have no bearing on our lives. I could do without.
But I'm getting the sense, reading between the lines, Ted, that somewhere within you there is a nostalgia for the four-cylinder engine and turbo the size of a dustbin and 1,000 horsepower.
Yeah. I mean, they're 1,000 horsepower now, but they've got all sorts of huge turbos in there. But, you know, there is a discussion at the moment, Anton, about how they might go back to the naturally aspirated engine. Certainly when I saw my first Formula One car when I was 12 or 13 at Brands Hatch in Kent, and I thought, you know what, it's that noise that gets me. And I never knew anything could be that loud, and I never knew a car could make that noise. And that's what excited me. And I'd like to think we could go back to those naturally aspirated engines. The V6s, the V8s, the V10s, never going to go back to the V12s. But yeah, one day maybe.
Why is the V12 stone dead?
I think they had even less relevance to road cars than any of the others. You still get cars with V8 engines now, but you don't really get them with V12s unless you want to pay millions of quid or euros for them. So they don't really have relevance. They're quite big. They're quite heavy. They sound great, but I don't think they're gonna have any relevance. They're more interested in V8s. And you know what? A couple of octaves missing, but that'll do for me as a good engine sound.
Now, having spent, as we said, the 3 decades in the sport, give us your favourite moment, whether it be from a race, whether it be from behind the scenes. What's the thing that was the pinnacle, the best gossip that you've had, or the best experience?
Well, from when I wasn't working, when I was just a kid watching, it's got to be the 1992 Monaco Grand Prix. When you think motor racing is all about overtaking people, but sometimes the most exciting bits can be when they don't manage to overtake. But Mansell was leading, had what he thought was a puncture, turned out just to be a little problem with the car, pitted, put on new tyres. Ayrton Senna took the lead, and then Senna, on knackered old tyres, defended his lead for about 10 or 12 laps with Mansell harrying him from behind. My sofa broke. I was jumping up and down on my sofa, so excited about something that didn't happen because Mansell didn't get by and Senna won the race. But these days, I don't know. I mean, it's got to be so many stories. Can I take it back to Belgium 1998 when Eddie Jordan got his first and only 1-2 with Damon Hill and Ralf Schumacher? I was in the commentary box with Murray Walker and Martin Brundle that day. And it was a tiny commentary box in Belgium. We're not given huge commentary boxes in that racetrack, but we were all jumping up and down. It had been a torrid race with lots of retirements. That wasn't the reason Jordan won. They were fast on the day, and Hill led Ralf Schumacher across the line. I'll never forget Eddie dancing down the pit lane afterwards. That was a joyous day.
Now, you mentioned Murray Walker. In a couple of sports, you sometimes get the sort of the definitive voice. We have George Hamilton with the football here. There was Bill McLaren in the rugby at one point. Murray Walker is at the absolute top of those. He defined the sound of Formula One for several generations. What was it like working with him? What was it like working without him then?
Well, it was a privilege, really, because here was a man who sounded like a racing car going at full tilt down the track, and that was the power of his voice. And he was a gentle man. He didn't have a crossword to say about anyone. He would always think the best of people. Sometimes when racing drivers would have questionable tactics, he wouldn't automatically come down and say, "Oh, that was a bit of a rum do," that he would refer it to. He'd always give people the benefit of the doubt. wasn't a cynical man at all, a lovely man, and had a appreciation that we could all understand and get behind for Formula One. And then everything else, I just think without him, it's different, but you still have David Croft now, and he's the voice of Formula One, and he comes up with these great moments in these great words and phrases and moments of drama that just hit the right spot. And that's all you can ask for your commentator, that you're listening, they're with you, they're on your side, they're watching with you in your sitting room, and they're summing up what you feel about watching whatever sport it is.
And of course, Brundle, who, I mean, I always had a soft spot for Martin Brundle as driver. I thought he didn't get quite the luck that he deserved, but he turned out to be a revelation behind the mic.
A reluctant genius is what I call him in F1's side of the book, because he never wanted to do it. He always felt that Eddie Jordan had cancelled it, had not renewed his contract at the wrong time, and he should have carried on with Jordan. And yeah, I mean, he was a bit reluctant because he didn't want to give up driving too fast. But his analysis, his incisive commentary, his honesty, and the amount of work he does behind the scenes. He spends the whole of Friday and most of Thursday as well going in, talking to engineers, to team owners, and getting those inside little stories that he'll just drop into the commentary now and again. If you're not noticing, if you're not listening, sometimes he'll drop that in. You cock your ear and you think, oh my goodness, what was that? I haven't heard that before. That's new. And that's why Brundle's so good as a communicator as much as anything else.
Let's come full circle then to finish near where we started. I asked you who was the best ever. You have in the long time, and it's all detailed in the book, F1 Insider Notes from the Pit Lane, you have dealt with and rubbed shoulders with all the various drivers. Who's the nicest?
Gosh, these days it's probably the likes of Alex Albon, who is just a very nice guy. Christian Horner, the departed boss of Red Bull, almost said the problem with Alex is that he's almost too nice to be a racing driver. And some of the champions don't need to be nice and don't want to be nice because they think that's not how you win championships. Other people might differ, but Alex Albon is certainly a nice guy. I always got on well with Michael Schumacher, actually. He was somewhat of a enigma on the track. He had some questionable tactics now.
Did he what?
But as a person, he was not a hard man as a person. He was actually a soft guy and a nice guy away from the track. He was always, he was lovely to his mechanics. He'd learn about, you know, their wife's names, their kids' names, their birthdays. He'd remember them, get them Christmas presents. He was a soft, nice man away from the track. But that changed when he put the helmet on. So, you might not think it, but Michael was a very nice man.
Ted, lovely to talk to you, and best of luck with the sales of the book. The book is F1 Insider Notes from the Pit Lane, and it is out now. Thanks to Ted.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.